Okay, great. So let's start. This is the final class in this mini-series on topics to do with Torah, science, and rationalism. And the topic for today is evolution. So, it's a very big topic. All right, yeah, I have a whole bookcase full of books on this topic, but we're going to try and get through the basics of it within the next 45 minutes to an hour. And what I always title my talks on evolution, the title I choose is Untangling Evolution, because what I find to be the most common problem is that there's a lot of different issues that are mixed together in people's heads. And when you tease them out, generally the topic kind of explains itself. So let's start with the question about what evolution means. Just earlier today I was reading a dispute between some people about whether evolution is scientifically valid or not. And I saw a very, very common mistake, which is that two different meanings of the term evolution were being used. It happens all the time. The problem is that the word evolution itself is used to describe two very different things. One is, I'll write them down here in the chat box so you can have the terms in your mind. One is common ancestry, what some people call common descent, and the other is evolutionary mechanisms. Okay, so what's common ancestry, what's evolutionary mechanisms? Common ancestry is the idea that all living creatures have a common ancestor. Right? Originally there was just one very simple life form, and from that developed the diversity of life that we have today. So in the same way as everyone participating in this forum, all what cousins, I don't know, tenth cousins, whatever. So further back, we're related to all the other animals, all the mammals are related, and more distantly, all vertebrates are related, and even more distantly, all animal life is related. Right? So common ancestry is the idea that creatures evolved into other creatures, without getting onto the question of how did that happen. And the second part of evolution is the mechanism of evolution. The issue of how did that happen? What is it? What is the mechanism which causes one creature to change into another creature? And so these are two very different things, right? Common ancestry is the what, and evolutionary mechanisms is the how. And the reason why this is very important is that the evidence for common ancestry is overwhelming, in my opinion, and in the opinion of pretty much the entire scientific community. Whereas with regard to evolutionary mechanisms, everyone, even the most ardent evolutionist, would agree that there's still plenty to learn about that. So very often you'll have these discussions where one person will say, evolution is a proven fact, and someone else will say, no, it's not, it's just a theory, and even scientists themselves agree that it's not proven. And what's happening is that they're talking about different meanings of the term evolution. The person who says evolution is a fact is talking about common ancestry, and which is sometimes called the fact of evolution. And it's called the fact of evolution because it's talking about a historical occurrence, that animals changed into other animals. Right? Simple life forms changed into fish. Fish changed into amphibians, into reptiles, into birds, into mammals. And that's overwhelmingly supported by lots of different evidence. Whereas the person saying that no, evolution is just a theory and it's not proven and there's lots of difficulties with it, he's talking about the mechanism of evolution, which is called a theory. And you have to remember though, the word theory when it's used in science does not mean the same as the word theory when used in regular conversation. When we use the word theory in regular conversation, we mean something that might be true and might well not be true. But theory in science, in scientific terminology, scientific discourse, theory is used to mean an explanation of a mechanism for something. Actually, you have gravitational theory. Gravitational theory is very robust. You know, I'm not going to walk off my balcony here and say, oh well, you know, gravity is only a theory. Right? The word theory in science means an explanation of a mechanism. And it happens to be in this case that everyone agrees there's still lots to learn about the mechanism. Right? So you'll have some differences of opinion amongst biologists as to how much of the mechanism do we really understand. Do we have a very robust explanation of the mechanism with just some roughness around the edges to figure out, or do we have a lot of questions about the mechanism? But that's what's we have to differentiate here between the fact of evolution, like common ancestry, the what, and the theory of evolution, the mechanisms, the how. Excuse me? Okie dokie. Now, although this class is really about the religious aspects of evolution, not the scientific aspects, I do want to just briefly mention the scientific aspect. Because someone just wrote here in the chat box that whenever we're talking about something that happened thousands or millions of years ago, you're dealing with theory. Now, I don't know who this person is. He's from Passaic. Now, the question is, would you say that about, you know, would you say that about the Exodus? But it's just a theory. Would you say that about the Jewish people entering, you know, would you say that about the existence of the Beis Hamikdash? Just a theory. Now, just because something happened a long time ago doesn't mean it's just a theory. You can have a lot of evidence that something happened. Okay. So in this case, there's a lot of evidence that all animal life is descended from a common ancestor. What is the evidence? So I'll just survey briefly, and again, this is not a scientific class, so if you want to learn more about that, then there's plenty of books that will explain it. But just to go over it briefly. So first of all, you have the fossil record. Now today, I noticed somebody saying that, well, there's all these missing links in the fossil record. It's true, there are some missing links. The fossil record is certainly not complete. The question is this. It's the wrong kind of thing to focus on. What we should be focused on is not, is the fossil record complete? Which, of course, it's not. I mean, for anything to fossilize requires certain very, very specific climatic conditions. Otherwise, it would just decay, completely decompose. And things only fossilize under certain conditions. So the question is not, do we have a perfect fossil record? Which, of course, we don't. The question is, instead, does the fossil record correspond more closely with the evolutionary model or with the non-evolutionary model? Now, the non-evolutionary model, the idea that God created all creatures separately, so, first of all, that doesn't predict any extinct species at all. Right? In fact, I have a chapter in my book, The Challenge of Creation, on extinction, showing how the Rishonim, the medieval Torah scholars, did not believe that any creatures could become extinct. For various reasons. Right, so certainly the fact that we found many, many extinct species, many more extinct species than surviving species itself, is evidence for the evolutionary model over the traditional simple model of creation. And the fact is, you know, people talk about, what about the missing links? Well, you know, what about the present links? Right, you have lots of intermediates. Let's take whales, for example. So you have creatures that lived a very long time ago, which were land-dwelling creatures with very long, whale-shaped like heads. And then a few million years later, you have the same creatures, but which are somewhat amphibious. You can see they're swimming, and that they swim by undulating their bodies up and down. And then you have primitive whales that have little legs, which the legs are clearly not big enough for really walking around with. So you have that pattern, so you could say, well, but what about the steps in between? Where are those? But actually, not just the opposite. What about the steps that we have? Okay, so it's much more, seems to me much more likely that the steps that we have show that the evolution happened and that we just haven't been able to find all the more fossils yet, rather than to say that whales did not descend from land animals, in which case, what are all these intermediate steps that we find? Same goes with dinosaurs, or with birds from dinosaurs. Right? You find dinosaurs with little rudimentary feathers, more advanced feathers. You find Archaeopteryx, which is basically the skeleton of a dinosaur. It has teeth in its jaws, has claws, has a long tail, long bony tail, but it also has fully developed, almost fully developed wings with feathers, and you have primitive birds with teeth. And so you have lots and lots of fossils showing intermediates. Then, even more strongly than that, it's just the overall pattern of life in the animal kingdom. Speaking of somebody who's studied animals my whole life, the overall pattern of life in the animal kingdom makes so much sense in light of common ancestry. Let's go back to whales. Take a whale and a shark. Right? Superficially, extremely similar. They've got flippers, they've got fins, it lives in the water. But anatomically, completely different. Once you get below the layer of the skin, so the shark has this cartilaginous skeleton, the whale, on the other hand, on the inside, has a skeleton that's very similar to land animals. Right, the same kinds of bones, inside the flipper of the whale, you have a five-fingered hand. Like, why skeletally is it so similar to land animals? Well, that makes a lot of sense if it's descended from land animals. And what about the fact that the whale has to come to the surface to breathe? Like marine mammals, they have to come to the surface to breathe. That's obviously a big disadvantage, right? If you are a whale stuck beneath the surface in the grip of a giant squid, or underneath the ice and you can't find an air hole, right? So, you're dead. It's obviously a big disadvantage to have to come to the surface to breathe and not to have gills, but it makes a lot of sense if they're descended from land animals. We get from flying creatures the same. You have a bat, right? A bat is superficially very similar to a bird. It has wings, it has flies, but anatomically completely different. And I have my pet bat downstairs, and he has these long fingers in his wing. Makes a lot of sense if he's descended from other mammals, rather than having another type of bird that for some reason is completely skeletally different and much more similar to mammals. So the whole way of organizing and making sense out of the animal kingdom makes much more sense in light of common ancestry. Somebody mentioned monotremes. Right, the duck-billed platypus. So that's in fact it supports what I'm saying. In other words, with the evolutionary model, evolution makes very specific predictions, testable predictions, about what kind of fossils you'll find. Now, evolution says that because mammals descended from reptiles, and birds separately descended from reptiles, so you'll find intermediates between reptiles and birds, and between reptiles and mammals, but you won't find any intermediates between mammals and birds, right? Because they're in different branches of the family tree. Right, so, and in fact, that's what we find. You don't find any griffins, right? There's no animals, mammals with four legs and wings, despite their appearance in some medieval Jewish sources, as you can see in my book, Sacred Monsters. But you do find intermediates between reptiles and birds and reptiles and mammals. Right? Reptiles and birds, we spoke about Archaeopteryx. Reptiles and mammals, so the duck-billed platypus. You see, there's nothing birdish about the duck-billed platypus. Its beak is not a bird kind of beak. It's very anatomically very different, and the eggs that it lays are not bird eggs, but much more similar to reptile eggs. So that's the point. Evolution makes very specific predictions about what you'll find and about when you'll find it. As somebody once said, you could disprove all of evolution just by what would it take? You find a fossil rabbit in the Cretaceous. Right? That's all it would take. That in one of the thousands of places where you find dinosaur fossils, find a fossil rabbit. Or any other contemporary mammal. That's all it would take to completely disprove evolution. You don't find those things. And what you find is over millions of years, a progression from simple animals to much more complex animals. And there's much more to talk about. We can talk about vestigial limbs, right? Emus. Emus are birds about 5 feet tall. They can't fly. They have little stubby wings about that big. Completely useless for flying, but it makes sense if they're descended from birds that had wings for flying. Right? There's many other examples of vestigial limbs in the animal kingdom, especially with regard to math, which we'll get to later. Okay, so like I said, that's just a very brief survey of some of the evidence for common ancestry. Before I forget, by the way, I should mention from the outset that everything I say is discussed and explained at much greater length in my book, The Challenge of Creation. Let's see if I have one here to show you. Nope. Should probably put it in that bookshelf. I should say that, for the record, I much prefer writing books than giving lectures, because in books it can be much more precise with my words and can back up things with sources, with footnotes. So, if you like this lecture, and especially if you don't, please read the book, because in the book I'm able to put things forward much better than I can in an audio lecture, especially because I speak without notes. Okay, so that's some of the evidence for common ancestry. Now let's move to the religious side of it, right? Because everyone knows, right, that there's this big conflict between religion and evolution, right? So what exactly is the nature of the conflict? People, please, you can type it into the chat box. If you can pinpoint exactly, what is the conflict between evolution and Judaism? Okay, with two suggestions so far. One person is saying age of the world, one person is saying contradicts literal reading of the Torah. There's some other answers coming in. Is man in the image of God or image of monkey? Anything else? Okay, so already we're seeing a few different answers. See, what I find is that when people talk about the conflict between Judaism and evolution, there's really a whole bunch of different potential regions of conflict which have to be untangled, right? Just like we untangled the science of evolution into two components, so too we have to untangle the religious conflict into its various components, break down exactly what each area of conflict is, and analyze them separately. So, here we've had three suggestions. I've actually found, personally, I've came across several different potential areas of conflict between evolution and Judaism. So one is the idea of the age of the world, right? The traditional, simple understanding of Bereshit is that the universe was created over 6 days a couple of thousand years ago, whereas evolution requires animals evolving over a period of hundreds of millions of years. Right? More broadly, modern science puts the age of the universe at being about 14 billion years in age. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time in that one, because it's not really the focus of this class, but basically, now, this is an old question which there have been many different responses to. Some people say that the 6 days of Bereshit don't need to be literal 24-hour days. They can be eras. Personally, that's not my favorite approach. I prefer to understand that Bereshit is not a scientific text. And as Rambam, Maimonides, writes in the Guide to the Perplexed, he writes, contrary to popular belief, the account of creation is not all to be interpreted literally. In which we see two important things. Number one, that the account of creation is not all to be interpreted literally. And number two, that that's contrary to popular belief, as Rambam says. So the idea is not to read the Bereshit as a scientific text, but rather to understand it as a theological text, teaching important lessons about the relationship of God to the universe, the purpose of the universe, man's place in the universe. That's how we want to be reading Bereshit, not as a scientific text. Right, so there's a long precedent of great rabbinical authorities who did not interpret Bereshit literally as presenting a scientific account of creation. If you're on all the sources, you can see the book Challenge of Creation, but it's not the I don't want to make it the focus of this class. For the same reason, the another aspect someone mentioned, the idea that in the Torah it mentions God creating man, animals, everything from the dirt. Whereas evolution says that animals are not made from the dirt, they're made from each other. So that's the same type of question, right? You're talking about a conflict between science and the literal meaning of Genesis. But it's the same kind of question to which the response is, well, who says Genesis is meant to be read literally as a scientific account of the development of the world? You have Rambam and many others who did not read Bereshit literally, and there's different ways of reading Bereshit, and I think the best way to read it is as a theological account of the nature of the universe, not as a scientific account. What I'd like to focus more on is the conceptual regions of conflict. Because to be honest, that's what I find to be bothering people more. What I think bothers people more is not really so much the conflict with a literal reading of the Torah. Because, you know, there's plenty of times when we take the Torah, when people today at least take the Torah non-literally, right? When the Torah has these anthropomorphic descriptions of God, right? His hand, his back, his eyes, his feet, right? So it's a lot, and there's a long precedent in Judaism of reading parts of the Torah non-literally, right? Shir HaShirim, right? Song of Songs, so certainly the Orthodox convention is not to read that literally, and then the Book of Eo, the Book of Job, so it's an opinion in the Gemara, which is adopted by Rambam, and even adopted by Artscroll, amazingly enough, which is that the entire account of Eo never happened. So the idea of not taking things from the Torah as being historic scientific is pressing for that. I don't think that's what really bothers people. I think what bothers people more is the conceptual problem here, which is as follows. These scientists, you know, they claim to have a scientific explanation for how life came about, but we know that God did it. Right, so people perceive science as threatening God's role in creation. as painting God out of the picture. As I saw someone say today, it's the Yetzer Hara, it's the evil inclination. Right? It's a way of explaining the complexity of the natural world without invoking God. That I think to be the primary objection to evolution. So what do we make of that? So, it's funny because even though this is a very widespread and common objection to evolution, it's really something that doesn't hold much water from a theological standpoint, and not only that, but it's something that could, in theory, apply to any region of science. Whenever you have a scientific explanation for something, you could say, oh, it's trying to paint God out of the picture. And traditionally, Judaism, well, we don't see it that way. We see God as working through the scientific mechanism. Right? We have a science of meteorology, which explains how weather works. We have astronomy, which explains the motion of the stars and the planets. And it's true that in the past, people did attribute these things to God. And in fact, one of the most unfortunate statements in Rambam is that Rambam says that you can't possibly explain in naturalistic terms the movements of the heavenly bodies, which proves that they have an independent intelligence, because we now know that we can. Right? We have laws of motion which do explain the movements of the stars and the planets without having to assume that they are intelligent beings with independent motion. So in a more broader scale, right, the idea of having a scientific explanation for something does not rule God out of the picture. Now, as I explained in the class a few weeks ago, it's true that what you do have here is a very fundamental difference between two schools of thought in Judaism. Whereas you have the rationalist school of thought and the non-rationalist or mystic school of thought. Right, the rationalist approach, most prominently led by Rambam, but also held by many other Rishonim and Achronim and so on, the rationalist approach is to always try and see God working through nature. It was to try and see a naturalistic explanation of things. That's how we want to see God working, through this orderly fashion. And the mystical approach is to prefer to see God in miracles. So it's true that it's only the rationalist school of thought that would want to see a naturalistic explanation for how life came about. But even the mystical school of thought acknowledges that there certainly are things that appear naturalistic. And even the most committed mystic, the most committed anti-rationalist would agree that science certainly can explain many things. And that does not rule God out of the picture. So while the mystic, the non-rationalist, might not want an evolutionary explanation for how life came about, surely they must admit that it doesn't contradict the idea of God. Because God works through nature. Now, when we say we make a bracha and bread, right, what do we say? Hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz. That God, we bless God who took the bread out of the ground. And what does that mean? Does it mean that the divine hand comes and plucks a loaf of bread out of the ground? Of course not. It means that God set up the laws of nature such that man can turn wheat into bread. Right, so, you know, it's funny because this is such a common objection to evolution, but when you think about it for a few moments, you realize, why would having a scientific explanation for something rule God out of the picture? It doesn't. It just means that God works through science, the same way God works through meteorology, the same way God works through history. And historical events where we see God's hand, the founding of Israel, the victory of the Six-Day War. It's not saying that there's no scientific explanation, no historical documentation of the forces of how this came about. Of course there is. But we see that God works through science, through history. So this very basic objection to evolution is really not justifiable from a theological standpoint. And this really leads on to the topic of intelligent design. So a lot of people have heard of this, especially in America, it's very big. You have this intelligent design movement, the ID movement, which is an opposition to the evolutionists. The intelligent design movement says that evolution falls short of explaining the complexity of life, and really if you look at certain phenomena in the animal kingdom, you see evidence of intelligent design, the hand of God. So instinctively, many religious Jews feel that they must be on the same side as the intelligent design team, right? Because they're saying that the natural world points to God, and we believe in God, so we must be on the same team. But in fact, I find the intelligent design camp very problematic from a theological standpoint. Right? Whether that's problematic from a scientific standpoint, it's not my position to say, because I'm not a biologist. But from a theological standpoint, the intelligent design group is very on very, very shaky ground. What are they saying? The intelligent design movement says that there are certain phenomena that are irreducibly complex, that there's no step-by-step evolutionary process which could have brought them about, and they must have been, you know, designed by God. And they give a few specific examples, the human blood clotting system, the bacterial flagellum. They say that these things, they say that it's true evolution can explain a lot of things, but evolution cannot explain these things. And I find that theologically very problematic. So what are they saying? God can do so much through the laws of science, and he can develop this amazing world through the laws of science, but when it comes to these things, he can't figure out how to do it, and he has to intervene? I find it theologically very problematic. Now, if we think of evolution, you know, what is the greatness of evolution from a theological standpoint? The greatness of it is that it shows the wisdom of God. It's an incredible feat of engineering. Here's an example I like to give. Take two engineers. Right, these two engineers have the job of building a whole different range of robots. So one of the engineers sets out and he builds all kinds of different robots. A land-walking robot, and a flying robot, an amphibious robot, an aquatic robot. The second engineer designs a computer program that can itself figure out how to make all different kinds of robots. Which engineer demonstrates the greater skill? Clearly, the second one. And it takes a lot more engineering skill to figure out a computer program that will itself develop all different kinds of robots than to have to build them all separately. Right? So that's what we see in evolution. In science itself, we see the wisdom of God. I want to share with you a quote from Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Where is it? Let me just find it and paste it in. Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, he addresses evolution at a time when it was just being introduced and there didn't seem to be that much evidence for it yet. And he himself personally did not believe in evolution. But what he wanted to do was speak about, well, what happens if evolution is ever proven. So what he says is as follows. Can you see the whiteboard on your screen? Can you see all the text in it? Can you just type in the chat box, tell me if you can see the text? No? Okay, there may be something you have to do. You may have to... You can see the whiteboard and you can't see the text, but you can't see a whiteboard at all. Now you see it? Okay. So look at this quote from Hirsch. Even if this notion of evolution were ever to gain complete acceptance by the scientific world, which it now has, Jewish thought and likely reasoning of the high priest of that nation, Darwin, actually it might be Huxley he meant, would nonetheless never summon us to revere a still extant representative of this primal form and ape as a supposed ancestor of us all. Rather, Judaism in that case would call upon its adherents to give even greater reverence than ever before to the one sole God who, and here's the crucial line, in his boundless creative wisdom and eternal omnipotence needed to bring into existence no more than one single amorphous nucleus and one single law of adaptation and heredity in order to bring forth from what seemed chaos, but was in fact a very definite order, the infinite variety of species we know today, each with its unique characteristics that sets us apart from all other creatures. And it's part of the creative wisdom. Now, it's the most phenomenal feat of engineering to design the laws of nature so that they will unfold and produce the tremendous diversity of animal life today. Now, the intelligent design group, who agree that this is the case for most things in nature, but they say, what, with these few things, the bacterial flagellum, the blood clotting system, that's when God didn't do it? Number one, it's a bit weird. You know, Judaism is all about you look at the natural world in its entirety and you see God. And not that Where do you see God? Only in the things that science can't explain. Only in the bacterial flagellum of the human blood clotting system. That's a very strange place to see God. And then we say, well, it's offensive. Well, what does it mean? That's what God can't do? He can figure out how to use the laws of nature to do everything else and not to do that? There's a very popular book, so I won't name the title of it, a popular book about, I think it's aimed more at kids perhaps, about Judaism and evidence for God and so on, and has a whole chapter about bird migration, in which he makes fun of the scientific explanations for how birds migrate. And the conclusion is, you know, these scientists think they can explain it, but of course they can't, and God did it. What's the idea here? That God can create laws of nature which take an egg and turn the egg into a bird, but in order to get the bird to find its way south, God can't figure out a way to do that through nature, and he has to intervene and actually physically point the birds in the right direction. You know, it's offensive, theologically offensive. Once you accept that God has this creative wisdom, which enables him to create so much of the natural world and run so much of the natural world through these incredible laws of science that he's made. So to say that in a few places, well, you know, God couldn't figure out how to get the programming to work there, so he has to intervene. It becomes a very offensive view of God. So that's my objection to the whole intelligent design camp. Now this in turn leads on to another point. So many people will say, okay, so they can accept the common ancestry that creatures evolved, right? And they'll accept that there's a naturalistic explanation of how that takes place because God works through nature. But the specific type of naturalistic explanation that Darwinian evolutionists propose, that's what they have a problem with. Why? Because the specific type of mechanism that's being proposed is one that depends on randomness. And it's about random genetic mutations and just a fortuitous chance of circumstance. Right? You'll have one deer which randomly, genetically mutates to have a longer neck, and it's just the chance circumstances of a drought, which means that the only leaves available are the ones on higher trees, so only those deer with the randomly longer necks are able to reach those leaves and survive to pass on more of their genes, and that's how you get a giraffe. Obviously oversimplified. But the idea is that evolution is contingent on random mutations and fortuitous, you know, chance circumstances. So they say this whole idea of randomness, that's the conflict with Judaism. Because Judaism believes that the universe is meaningful, is purposeful, is directed by God. That is a plan for creation, not that things are just random. Now again, that's something that when you think about it, you instantly realize the problem here without objection. Because all science says is that things superficially appear to be random. Now Judaism agrees with that. Of course there are things that appear to be random. Throwing a dice. Drawing a lottery. Of course there are things that appear to be random. Judaism acknowledges that. But the point is that behind that randomness, that is a way in which God can operate. In fact, that is the entire message of the Purim story. That you have all these events, which occurred over many years. There's no overt miracles in the Book of Esther. Right? No obvious hand of God. You have all these just seemingly random chance events. But at the end of the day, after many years, you look back and you see what they resulted in, and that's where you see the hand of God. Not in any overt supernatural acts, but in the end result of these seemingly chance events. And the same can be with evolution. You have all these chance random events. But at the end of millions of years, when you look around and you see this incredible diversity of animal life, you see the human brain, which is the most complex organ in the known universe, so you realize, wow, this is not just a random universe. This is a universe which has been pre-programmed such that the laws of nature, with these astonishing laws of nature that have these incredible, spectacular results. So, you know, all evolution can say is that the universe appears to be random, which, of course, things appear to be random superficially. But that doesn't say anything about the ultimate nature of the universe. And again, I find the comparison with history to be very important. You talk about modern history. So, from a cold scientific perspective, okay, it's just random chance, you know, fortuitous events. But as Jews, as believing Jews, we acknowledge what happens superficially. I'm talking about specifically the formation of the State of Israel and the survival of the Jewish people and the victory of the Six-Day War and so on. Of course, there's no overt miracles, no overt supernatural acts, but You look at the end result of these seemingly chance events, and you see the Jewish people come back to the land after thousands of years, think which there's no historical precedent. You see a survival against the odds, so we've turned the, made the desert bloom. You see providence, you see the hand of God. So, in all these cases, you know, when you think about the theological objections to evolution that are being raised, you think through them, you realize that ultimately they fall down. That evolution is no different from any other branch of science, no different from any other branch of science, no different from astronomy, no different from history, political history, military history. It's just explaining a physical process. But that physical process says nothing about the ultimate metaphysical purpose. Okay. I want to now move on to a different aspect of evolution, which is that many people, they're fine with the, or they can tolerate the evolution insofar as evolution of animal life. But when it comes to evolution of humans, that's when they draw the line. I remember my own dear mother, she was horrified when she found out that I published a book about evolution, really upset. Eventually she came to terms with it, but she said to me, you know what, Nathan, if you want to believe that you're descended from monkeys, okay, go ahead, but just don't tell me that I am. So, you know, that's what many people have a problem with. You know, Judaism says we're made in the image of God, not in the image of monkeys. Whereas these evolutionists, and they claim that we're in the image of monkeys. Okay, so first of all, to survey the physical evidence for human evolution, like with animal evolution, there's lots of evidence. Right, first of all, the fossil record, you have lots of intermediate stages, like Australopithecus and Cro-Magnon man and all those. And it's true there were some hoaxes, right? There were some fakes, some hoaxes, but it doesn't make a difference. Right? You have fake and the hoax Jewish texts too, it doesn't invalidate the entire Jewish canon. Right? The fact is, there's lots of fossils of hominids that are not humans. Then you have the fact that a lot of physical features of humans, which are very difficult to understand if you believe that God made man from scratch, but it makes a lot of sense if God made man using the raw material of animals. For example, the appendix. Right? I once nearly died from appendicitis. Thousands of people, even in the United States, thousands of people die from untreated appendicitis every year. Now, I wouldn't say that there's no benefits from the appendix. Now, there could be some minor benefits, but there's certainly more. The downside certainly outweighs the benefits, right? I mean, you can live without it. Not having an appendix is not going to kill you. Having an appendix could well kill you. And so why do we have an appendix? Well, it makes sense if we evolved from animals in which the appendix is a more functional organ. Goosebumps, when you're scared, when you're cold, right? So the hairs on your arms and the back of your neck stand up. What does that accomplish? Nothing at all. However, if we're descended, if it's a remnant, genetic remnant from when we were animals. So in animals, it helps a lot when your hair stand up. If you're scared of a predator and your hair stand up, it makes you look bigger, more threatening. The predator might back off. If you're cold and your hair stand up, it gives more insulation. Wisdom teeth cause a lot of pain, but if we used to have larger jaws, it makes sense that we have them. The lower back pain. I've got this cushion because I got lower back pain. Right? A lot of people suffer from that as they get in their 30s or 40s. But if we're evolved from animals, we were originally on all fours, and then, so the spine originally was engineered for a horizontal posture, only later did it get pushed into service for upright, then it makes sense that because it was only subsequently pressed into use for that, that it doesn't hold up so well. So a lot of features of the human being, which cause a lot of problems, even from a theological perspective, make a lot more sense if God used this incredible mechanism of evolution to design humans. But what about us being in the image of monkeys? So, you know, yet again, this is very curious. You know, there are a lot of very, very serious conflicts between science and Judaism, but evolution is not one of them. And especially when it comes to human evolution, it's just bizarre that these supposed objections, if there was a real problem here, I would say so, but there isn't. You have Rishonim, right? Medieval Torah scholars, who, writing way before anyone had any notion of evolution, said that man was first created as an animal, and then he was given a neshama and became human. Now, they weren't saying that man had physically evolved from animals, but what they said was that when man was created from the dirt, he was first created without a soul, but he could walk around and so on. And this is Ramban and others who say this. And subsequently, he was given a soul, and that's when he became a human being. And that's the crucial point, because you see that what makes us human, it's not our physical appearance in any way. What makes us human is our divine soul. But from the physical point of view, our physical bodies, of course, we have an animal body. And that is that is part of classical rabbinic thought, that man is a combination. He has an animal body with a spiritual soul. So all evolution says is that our physical bodies descended from animals. Or ascended, perhaps, is the word we should use. And sure, Judaism has no problem with that. Judaism just says that we have an additional component. We have an neshama, a soul, that sets us apart from animals. Right? No, animals do not make free will, do not choose between good and evil, do not forge a relationship with their creator. That's the crucial thing that sets us apart from animals. But with regard to where our bodies came from, whether our bodies came from monkeys, or from fungus, or from the dirt of the earth, right? It doesn't make a difference from a theological perspective. In fact, Judaism itself says that man was originally created as an animal, because that's the point. And in fact, some of the Rishonim also say that why is man created on the sixth day of creation, along with the animals? Can't we get our own day? Can't we be the most special part of creation? Why can't we have our own day? So what they explain is, that's the whole point. The man was created as an animal, but again, then given the potential to rise above that. And if you use that potential, then you become something more than just an animal. If you don't, then you effectively no better than an animal. So Judaism certainly has no issue with man's body physically evolving from animals. Judaism sets apart from secular science, and that Judaism believes that we rise up, or at least we have the potential to rise up and be much more than that. So that is a very, very brief overview of the evolution topic. Like I say, there's really so much more to discuss, so much more that I didn't get a chance to touch on, but you'll have to read the book, The Challenge of Creation, which you can find at bookstores, or if you're not, order it online from my website, zootorah.com. Any questions? Okay, excellent questions here. Why is the account written that it could be taken literally? The account of creation? So, that's a very hard question. Don't have a great answer for it. It is something I just present a few possibilities in the book. One idea is that it was the idea that the Torah is written, Dibur Torah Kelashon Bnei Adam, the Torah is written in the language of man, which according to many authorities means in man's conceptual framework. That basically God had to, the Torah has to accommodate what people's view of the universe was, in terms of the people that received the Torah, and incorporate its spiritual messages within that. Right? So you have to take into account what people at the time believed about how the universe developed, and then weaving in with that theological ideas, as opposed to starting from scratch and giving a whole new account, which would be very difficult to pull off. Like Rambam says that. Rambam says about how it's very difficult to get people to change, and that the Torah had to accommodate what people believed, what people thought. So you have to work with their existing framework, and then mix in the spiritual messages. Stanley asks about Adam and Eve. I noticed he didn't write Adam with a capital A. Was that a mistake? What was his name? Can people, Stanley or anyone else, can you people write in the chat box? What was his actual name? What did his wife call him? Okay, the chat box here has gone silent. What was his actual name? Ish? No, his name wasn't Ish. Ish means a person. His name was not Adam. If you look in the Chumash, look at the Torah, it's Ha'adam, the man. It's always the man. The only place where it doesn't appear with a hey is where there's a lamed before, and for grammatical reasons the hey gets dropped. But it's very clear in the Torah that his name was not Adam. I guess, you know, because he's not given a name, so we've got used to calling him Adam, what else are we going to call him? But it's not his name. So, it's very odd. Like, why is he not given a name? So that's an indication towards the approach of Rambam, the guide for perplexed, that what the Torah is doing here is not describing a historical account of a particular person, right, Mr. Adam, but rather telling us something about prototypical man, the idea of man. Right? According to Rambam, the whole episode of the man in the Garden of Eden did not actually happen, and it's not talking about a specific person. Rather, it's talking about the paradigm of man's existence in the universe. So, it's an approach which is that not to read the early parts of Bereshit as a historical account of a particular person, but speaking about the concept of mankind. Again, there's various nuances and various differences in this approach, different possibilities within this overall approach. Okay, somebody asks, does the Talmudic statement of there being 974 generations before man in Chagiga hint at the evolutionary process as Chazal knew it? I don't think so. I mean, Chazal did not know about the evolutionary process. I mean, you're not going to find mention of evolution amongst Chazal, amongst the Rishonim, for the same reason that you're not going to find discussion of dinosaurs. They had no reason to believe in it. They weren't confronted with any of the scientific evidence for it. What I think it does show is that you see that there was a lot of flexibility about interpreting Bereshit. You see that there's all kinds of different approaches to Bereshit that you'll find in the Chazal, the medieval period. You see that none of them felt wedded to the simple literal reading of Bereshit. They all had all different kinds of approaches to the text. It's only lately that people have become dug in their heels. And I'll be honest, what I really feel is that most of the disputes between Jews about age of the universe, evolution, have very little to do with theology and a lot more to do with sociology. And why do people take very strong positions on this topic? When, like I said, there's other issues, conflicts between Torah and science, but they're much more serious, biblical criticism and so on. But it's this one that the people get very worked up on. Why? I think it has to do with sociology, which is in a few ways. Now, firstly, it's become the big debate in America between the religious right, religious and non-religious, because it's become very political, right? Democrat versus Republican. And amongst Jews, it's become, a sign of sociological identification. Do you identify with the frum world or not? So I think for a lot of people, their passion and their very position they take in all these issues has a lot more to do with what sector of society they want to affiliate with than with any objective evaluation of this issue. Any other questions? A few more questions coming in here. Chat box has gone silent. Maybe people have second thoughts. Okay, so we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining me for these classes. Don't forget, if you want to learn more about these topics, so apart from my books, I also have a blog, rationalistjudaism.com, where you can find lots of different material. I'm not posting so much on there these days, but in the archives there's lots of stuff. And I have my main website, which is soon going to be redesigned, appearing in a new version, zootorah.com. I'll be coming to the US in February in a lecture tour. I'll be posting the details of that to my blog soon. Thank you for joining me and have a great week.